This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Thursday, August 31st, 2023. I'm Jeff O'Neill here with Rebecca Shinsky. And we definitely, Rebecca, needed to record this episode for Monday. We absolutely
knew that we had advertising
responsibilities to record this for Monday. Actually, we didn't. Rebecca, just before we got on the call, said, Jeff, I think we forgot that Monday is Labor Day, and we typically black out holidays, so we don't have to make stuff. We don't have to do the show. And I said, Rebecca, how dare you? Think of the listeners.
Think of the listeners. You're so magnanimous. That's why we're here.
That's right. That's why we're here. We had an agenda. We've been gone too long. And you're going to be out next week. So, we got to check in here real quick. Make sure everybody's okay. The book world's all right. How are things going? Do you think books are fine? Do they seem fine?
I think books are okay. You know, the vibes are fine. The vibes are fine enough is where I'm at. Fine enough, yeah. But we do need to reassure the people that, you know, the Shinsky O'Neill show will go on.
Right.
4 weeks of us not on this show together. I don't think that's acceptable.
I don't think, you know, we'd probably get a letter from the government, you know, just making sure everything's fine. Get a little check-in and have an inspector come by. I was in the UK for the last couple weeks. You're going somewhere next week. Do you want to say where you're going? I don't think I know where you're going.
Yeah, I'm going to Italy. We are celebrating Bob's 40th birthday a bit belatedly. We're going to the Amalfi Coast for a week.
So we've had multiple European sojourns between the two of us over the last few months. While I was in the UK, I did some bookstore snooping. I'm not much of a bookstore tourist when I go, but I did it for the show, Rebecca, because I needed to see what these bookstores look like that have been it's like the Beatle the British invasion for bookstore formats. Last year.
I'm appreciating that context because I was surprised when your texts to me from vacation were from bookstores.
So I was, again, I typically wouldn't. In fact, I had to go out of my I went out of my way, but only to take some pictures, and I was just curious to see what they were like there. But we're going to get to that later in the show. Let's do our first sponsor break and do some follow-up.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family, and lovers, and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by K.T. Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
This is not the first time you've heard Rebecca and I talking if you subscribe to our Patreon, because right now we record before I went out of town, and it went up on Tuesday. The fall draft extravaganza is up. So if you are already a member of the Patreon, make sure you go check that out. If you are not and that's interesting you, to go do it. We did the thing we normally do. We each tried to create the best basket of books for the general reader, that no one votes according to that, but that's what we do anyway. That is the pantomime that we play. And you can go vote over there. Coming on first edition early next week, the September It Books knockout round. So there's a little bit of crossover between those two things, which was one of the more difficult things I've done in my life. You know, I did some graduate school. I've had children. I was present. I've raised children, started a company. But picking between Ross Gay and some others at the end, I really had to take a cold look into the abyss on that one.
It was tough. I was looking back at the draft this morning, and I think our two baskets might be the best set of 20 books we've picked for a season in the several years that we've been doing.
Yeah, it's really good.
And it's such a good crop of books. And you're right, doing the It Books for first edition, I knew it was going to be tough, but it was really tough.
Yeah. So go check those things out. There'll be links in the show notes there. I think by the time this show comes out, go subscribe to first edition anyway. Had a couple of wonderful guests while I was gone. I need to go promote that on the first edition channels, but had Josh Cook. Oh, you heard people listen. That was
the
dropped.
People
into
heard
this.
Josh
people
Cook.
People heard
yes.
that. The one that didn't get dropped in that released while I was gone was a two-parter. The first section, Sharifa and Jen, Book Riot conspirators with us, came in to talk about how to make an anthology. They have a new anthology out called Fit for the Gods, Greek Mythology Reimagined. Talked a little bit. We didn't actually talk about that book too much, except that we did, because it was how to make an anthology. Jen's done two of these. This is Sharifa's first time. How you get, you know, how the business of it works, how the agenting and editing and the payments and all the things. We really got into it there a little bit. It was really great. Professor Farah Karim Cooper, who is the director of education at Shakespeare's Globe Theatre and a professor of Shakespeare at University of London, came on to talk about her new book called The Great White Bard, talking about race in Shakespeare, which was really, really interesting and a helpful context to think about how to keep Shakespeare feeling not like a moldering old white guy, because it's not that simple, and the mm-hmm. pleasures and challenges of thinking and reading Shakespeare in the context of race. I've got another. So the It Book Knockout coming out next week on first edition will also have, in the second half of that, I talked to Professor Jenny Nuttall, who is a professor of old medieval languages at Oxford. Her new book called Mother Tongue, The History of Women's Words, I found really interesting. She went back and each chapter is on some part of women's life, and she uses that context expansively in a modern way. You know, what's the history of words about menstruation and sex and work and pain? It was really good. And she, when you talk to an old English professor at Oxford, you do realize that the greater nerd, the greater nerd theory is true. There's always a greater nerd. And I like to think of myself as a logophile, a bibliophile, an educated man, Rebecca.
Yes. One of the great nerds.
Yeah, I would say I'm in the second or third rank, maybe at best, after talking to Professor Jenny and other people I've talked to, you know, Sarah Bakewell and Sarah Hart. I mean, these lots of Sarahs. Sarahs may need to join our power ranking of first names.
Of Anns.
Anns and Jonathans and Allisons. Yeah. But please go check out First Edition if any of that stuff seems interesting to you. The link in the show notes there. Also, go check out the deep dive. You did a bunch of newsletter stuff while I was gone. Talk to me about some of the newsletter stuff you were doing.
I just wrote my face off in August, which was really fun.
You'd have to talk to me for 2 weeks. Like, I'm going to make words.
You know, it is strange, though, after having done this show for 10 years, like, I don't fully process the news if we're not talking about it with each other.
Oh, so I did. Yeah.
You were missed. But I did take some of the time while I wasn't on conference calls, since that's one thing that does happen when you're gone, is my calendar frees up, to revisit the bridges of Madison County.
Incredible stuff.
Which was, it was such a trip. The it's the first Oprah sensation that I remember. Like, I was 11. I remember coming home from school. My mom would watch Oprah every afternoon. And I remember, like, seeing the Oprah craze about the bridges of Madison County. If you had asked me before this month what was, like, the book that kicked off Oprah's book club, I would have told you it was the Bridges of Madison County. But that was in 1993. She didn't start the book club until 1996. I suspect that how big that book went after she talked about it might have been, like, the impetus to start thinking about a book club.
Right.
But I sneak read it when I was 11 years old. It's about people having an extramarital affair. Most of it went over my head. And I discovered in rereading it that some of the scenes that I thought I remembered from the book are definitely scenes I was remembering from the movie.
Yeah.
So I had to, like, really straighten myself out, but I had a very entertaining afternoon. It's a 188-page paperback. The font is huge. I read it in, like, 3 hours. And I sent a lot of unhinged video messages to friends while I was like, you've got to hear these sentences. It's not bad, but it's not good. And it gave me a real opportunity to think about, like, what makes a book become a viral sensation. It has a lot of things in common, actually, with 50 Shades of Grey and with the Colleen Hoover books. It's a big, sweeping, unrealistic, romantic story. It's the only one of those that has been that big that's been written by a man, which makes it interesting. It gives us some, like, glimpses of at least what one man thought women wanted in 1993.
Well, hold, Nicholas Sparks is very mad somewhere, right? I know he wasn't picked by
true.
Oprah, but it does feel like the Nicholas Sparks phenomenon is a direct descendant of whatever the genetic material sloshing around the ocean was for Bridges of Madison
County. Yeah, that's interesting. Like a soft romance kind of situation. Yeah. There's not any sex in Nicholas Sparks, though, I don't think. That's like a fade to black situation. And certainly, like, going back into the media coverage of the Bridges of Madison County, the sex was one of the draws to this book, which is a real head scratcher because it is some of the more bizarre sex writing I've ever read. It's like somehow both not descriptive, but also very, very ridiculous. I don't know. It was just a whole thing. I read like a 10-page section of it out loud to Bob at one point, and he was just like, are you okay?
Which is like a third of the book, right? That's like 10 pages.
Right.
Like, you're almost done. Just finish your
right.
Off.
And the boning doesn't start until 100 pages in. So like, you gotta get through some other stuff before that can happen. It was a really good time. I had fun going back and reading a lot of coverage of it and people thinking about it. And it was interesting to try to, like, contextualize this viral sensation alongside the ones that are contemporary for us. Because, Jeff, the Bridges of Madison County sold 60 million copies.
I mean, for a single title, that is remarkable. When are we going to stop being surprised that a book that's a romance written for the average book reader, which is a woman, frankly, and that's romance, is a big hit. When are we going to stop being surprised by this? Like, the next time, just remind me of this, remind the whole book world, the next time this fourth wing or whatever, it's dragons having sex and then also people having sex, they're like, oh God, I can't believe it. It's like, wait a minute, let's go all the way back to, like, the Canterbury Tales. When having right. something that is a little more, you know, loose than the average book being released is available, we got to be smarter than this, Rebecca. We got to remember history a little bit.
And it's just astonishing. Like 60 million is three times the total sales Colleen Hoover has done with 24 books.
We used to be a country.
You know, and it's almost
Jonathan
half.
Listening Civigal would sell 100 million copies, and The Prince of Tides would sell 50 million copies, and everyone would be complaining about it, and then the publishing industry would go on.
Yeah, and it's almost half of the total sales of 50 Shades of Grey, which had three books, and like, you know, both of those authors had the internet to help them.
Every Methodist woman in America read that book.
Oh, yeah. Like, my mom read it. My friend's moms had it on the coffee table. I think I said in the deep dive piece, I have a memory of seeing it on my teacher's desk at school, but I don't know if that's real or
wow.
not. It's, like, totally believable, though. It's very possible.
It felt like it was part of the
everywhere.
Furniture. It was everywhere.
Yeah, it was everywhere. And so it was a real trip to, like, go back as an adult and read both the book and the coverage around it. And really, it's astonishing that there's not more... like contemporary look backs at the Bridges of Madison County. That was such a big
deal. Because at least, there's no movie stars, right? It's just Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep. So,
right.
No, they don't have much of a career to look back on.
Right, just Meryl Streep. Come on. Like, yeah. It was really wild. And that, of course, got me thinking about Oprah. And so then my later piece for the deep dive was about my general relationship to Oprah's book club. And in the course of writing it yesterday, I kind of came to the conclusion that maybe I owe a significant chunk of my career in books to the fact that Oprah... like shaped my reading values. So it's been fun. Folks can subscribe at bookriot.substack.com. You're on duty coming up here for the deep dive.
Yep. I wrote today, I was a little unhinged myself. I'm jet lagged, but not. I'm sleeping like 9:30 to 4 right now, which is kind of about as much as I normally sleep, but it feels a little bit like, I don't know, I'm slightly out of phase with my real life. And it came through in my writing today. For Day in a Book. Speaking, you know, I mentioned a book. We'll get into news here in a little bit. I didn't put this in the show notes because I literally just saw it when I was looking at the bookmarks. So the ripped bodice in L.A. Now, I have to distinguish now because there's two ripped bodices.
Oh, right.
Brooklyn
yeah.
now, right? Is having a midnight release party for a book coming out this fall. Have you seen this story? Did you read
it?
You probably didn't see this.
I have not.
Well, let's play the game where I know something and you don't.
My favorite.
Do you have any idea what it is? And I can go through a series of hints, and I'll see how long it takes you to get there.
Okay, so, well, I mean, it's going to be a romance title. It's coming out this fall. So it's not out yet. Is it? What month is it? Can I ask
I believe
questions?
November. I believe it's November.
Oh. I have no idea. Is it Regency?
No. Your first clue is the first book in the series came out this year already.
Oh. I have no idea.
Let's see. It is a romantasy. It's a romantasy. That's your next clue.
Is it some kind of Sarah J. Maas situation?
No, I mean, it's not Sarah J. Maas, but, you know, if we were playing Marco Polo, the polos are getting louder.
Getting a little closer.
Yeah.
I do not think I'm going to be able to even ask questions into my way to this answer.
Yeah. Your last clue is that dragons definitely have sex in this book.
Is it a Rebecca Yarros?
It is. It's the next one in the Rebecca.
Oh, okay,
it's called The Iron Flame. It's coming out in
November. I
forget
that those are both this year. Okay.
I think that's part of their. I'm trying to get someone from. I'm in conversation with people at Red Tower, which is the publisher, to talk about this phenomenon.
It's good momentum.
Trying to figure something out. So here's another question. I don't know the answer to this, and this we might need some listener feedback. What is the last book that you would bet a substantial amount of money on had a midnight release at a bookstore?
Oh.
I really struggled. I struggled. I don't know. I don't know if it has to be a series, right? I just don't know what it would be.
Yeah, I think
one of those Hunger Games books. And this is not all Barnes and Noble. This is very specific. But this is a thing that used to happen. Harry Potter's, the Suzanne Collins's. I think probably one of the Veronica Roths did.
Mm-hmm.
When's the last book that I remember having a midnight release? I can't think of one.
I think somebody did them for, was it Grey? Was that the title of the 50 Shades of Grey, but told
from
the dude's perspective?
Oh, that would make sense.
I feel like I
saw
that.
They trotted that out and no one showed up? Maybe people showed up, I don't know.
Because by the time E.L. James had the Penguin Random House deal for the original trilogy, all the books had already been out, self-published. So there was no like fanfare about publication date.
Right.
I think it would have been that, or maybe Stephanie Meyer had something in the last couple of years.
But that's... But since then, like The Chemist, that was that big Stephanie Meyer book. Anyway, you can hear us searching. That's the answer to that question. It's been a hot minute. You know, I don't know. I mean, this is very specific. And one thing I was talking to someone about recently is these book talk phenomenons. Oh, I guess you and I were talking about. I don't know where. I guess maybe it was on the Knockout Round. That's all meshing together now. They seem to like burn through their communities quickly, but kind of end there. And I wonder if this is the kind of thing we might see where a romance bookstore, a science fiction fantasy bookstore, a mystery thriller bookstore, maybe they will have a midnight release party for something, but where every bookstore from, say, Alexandria, Virginia to Orange County to Tacoma, Washington has a party, that's going to be something. I mean, that's going to take some doing. It's not on the horizon.
The mainstream hit that all the Barnes, like when I was a bookseller, we had midnight release parties for the latest Harry Potter and the new Twilight books. That's right. I think even a new Hunger Games, like that was
Mockingjay definitely had midnight release parties. I remember that distinctly.
And every Barnes & Noble store was doing those. And like all the bookstores and all the chains were doing those. Borders still existed at the time. That's how old I am. So
when you lined up for My Struggle 4, was that midnight or was that like at 10 a.m.?
You got to do that one in the stone cold light of day, my friend.
Yeah. It's a walk of shame to the bookstore for that.
But yeah, I think I wonder too with the just the prevalence of e-reading now, but also how prevalent genre reading, especially romances in e-books. Like if you are, I understand the appeal of like, if you're a big fan of a particular author wanting to go and like gather with community, and the romance reading community does this better than I think any other genre community does, of like getting together and creating hype around a thing and joining together to like all go do the same activity or celebrate the same book. But like, do they want to go to a midnight release party when the thing could hit your e-reader at midnight?
Very tough.
And you could be cozy in your bed and like start reading it the next morning. I don't know. Yeah. It's interesting to see those four. I guess the Rebecca Yarros lives in that like upper YA crossover to adult zone where maybe folks are young enough to want to be up at midnight to buy a book.
Well, it's a good point. That it's really for, I think you start topping out in a real way. Again, there's going to be outliers and awesome people that don't fit into these molds. But once you hit that 3 as the first digit in your age, I think it's just less interesting.
Yeah, I don't know who would have to have a book coming out for me to like trot myself down.
I mean, we're getting Groff and Smith and Ward, and we're not. None of us are like, let's get up at midnight. I mean, who else are we going to get?
Right, it's true.
Yeah. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting
to see. I'll be curious to see what the follow-on sales for that. Well, if that doesn't have Spredges, they're too smart not to have Spredges.
I want to forget that Spredges are a thing. Can we?
I'm
just
here
never...
to remind you that this is something that's happening.
Well, while you were gone, I do want to reassure you that Kelly talked about Bigalus Dickalus in your absence, just to keep that terminology alive and well on this podcast too.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to move on from that. Some follow-up from what you did last week. What do you want to hit here? I have to admit I haven't listened, but what do you want to make sure people know about?
A couple weeks ago when Kelly Jensen was here with me, one of the stories we talked about was a New York Times piece about how big the Book of Hove exhibit about Jay-Z's life and work was at the Brooklyn Library. And the Times piece was really shouting out, like, there are these 13 sort of gotta catch them all limited edition library cards. This has led to, I think it said, like 11,000 new accounts being created. This is a huge success. The library is doing this great thing. And I got a really thoughtful email from a listener named Jen, who I think provided like the exact kind of yes and context that I most appreciate, which is like, yes, this is a great interesting thing. It was a super thoughtful, detailed email. Thank you for your trust in that, Jen. But she was saying, yes, this is interesting. And also, there are some real downsides to having an event like this and hype like this at a library. And those can mostly be summed up in it takes space away from other resources that regular library patrons need. It takes time away that the librarians could be spending helping patrons. And there were some complaints from regular library patrons that the Book of Hove was doing them a disservice. In her email to me, Jen sent a link to a story from a website called Hellgate, which covers New York related news, that asks, is the Book of Hove really for anyone but Jay-Z? So we can provide that in the show notes here for additional context. And Jen even went like one further and said, you know, like, I think one of the reasons that the New York Public Library has done this is that Mayor Eric Adams had threatened to cut like many millions of dollars from public library funding. And he is a hip hop fan who understands the way Jen phrased it was hip hop as social currency, as capital. So this was really smart on the Brooklyn Public Library's part to plan this event that would go so big and show the mayor that, hey, the library is relevant, it's doing a big thing, you shouldn't cut our funding. And so, like, really, libraries are trying to balance all of these things at the same time, serving their regular patrons, staying relevant with local politicians so they can maintain their funding. And that's, it's too many things to balance. But I really appreciated having that picture more fully fleshed out than just like, yay, look, this is cool and interesting, which is certainly the angle of the New York Times piece. And also the response that I had to it of like, this is awesome. It's doing growth things for the library. More visibility for the library, more of the time, more people convinced that the library is cool, more of the time. That's great. And so I just wanted to share that with our listeners. Again, we'll put the link in the show notes, but also a thank you to Jen and an invitation for folks. Anytime you have additional context that we could and should know about, we do love to hear about it. So thank you.
Okay. We got the first salvo in the end of year awards. Kirk is first out of the gate with its list of finalists. Really, I mean, you want to talk about best of the year creep? How about awards creep? You know, that's the galaxy brain here. That's the real story, is awards creep. Anyway, worth looking at because we find this interesting. And I think you and I have been tracking as closely as ever the relative cultural imprint and critical and, you know, sales imprint of books, especially in the kind of books that would win the Kirkus Prize. 10 nonfiction, 10 fiction. I'd say for us a fairly good showing on books we've talked about or have read, especially the ones that have been out. You can vouch for Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton. You spoke well about that. I have not read that yet. I will eventually. We have both gushed over The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store. Yes. We are both eagerly anticipating Jesmyn's Ward, Let Us Descend, and How to Say Babylon by Safia Sinclair,
yes,
which you will hear us gush about, being excited about in a different context if you listen to First Edition. I can vouch for Our Migrant Souls by Hector Tobar. And then you who hate Paul Murray, you badmouth Paul Murray,
do you have anything to update about this?
Do you have anything to say for yourself? The bee sting here.
I read The Bee Sting while you were on vacation, and it is effing phenomenal.
I heard it's amazing.
Yes, I got FOMO where I had this galley.
It's not even
of the
out
bee
yet.
Sting.
How can you have FOMO when it's not
well,
out yet?
Look, I had the galley. I had the Coastal galley of Elite. The Bee Sting, and I was looking at it, and I was also like, I went to put another book on the bookshelf in my living room, and I saw Skippy Dies, and I was like, am I really gonna not read a new Paul Murray? I should at least try. It's like, I love Skippy Dies. I did finish the second novel that he wrote that I now cannot remember the title of, that had
tough
to do
look.
With like
tough look for that novel.
Like the vagaries of an Irish banking crisis.
Yikes.
It is so good. And like every one of the 650 something pages was worth it.
Wow.
I can talk about it more in Front List Foyer in a little bit, but that's my big news flash from you went on vacation.
Okay.
I went rogue and read Paul Murray, and now my money's on Paul Murray for this Kirkus Prize.
Yeah, I was reading a piece, was it the New Yorker somewhere, saying, you know, this is the leader in the clubhouse for the Booker Prize, which is a bigger fish even than the Kirkus Prize. So that's interesting. Some books we've seen and talked about. I will not be reading How Not to Kill Yourself by Clancy Martin, which is about his struggles with suicide and the topic of suicide writ large, though I've heard it's excellent. There's some other things there. Go check it out. I guess for me, the first thing, especially coming off Knockout Rounds and Fall Draft stuff that we've done, notable not to see either the Big Z or Groff here.
Yeah, and they're both published in the window for the Kirkus Prize, the eligibility window. It is interesting, especially, not to see Zadie or Lauren Groff.
You know what the hipster pick, I think, is for the year? It's the Kelly Link, White Cat, Black Dog. I see people talking about this. I always walk by it, and I like her. Again,
I like
short
her
stories is a little tough, but that one has been bubbling around, and I may get to that one eventually there. So go go check all of those things out. Let's do one more sponsor break, and I'm going to tell you about how the British book industry is wrong.
Can't
and
wait.
I am right about things.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story can make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of. And bonus points because it's Finnish. And when's the last time you read a Finnish dystopian science fiction novel? Right, okay. So in this one, humanity is destroying itself as the cities burn, which sounds kind of familiar. It is the time of the great affliction. In this terrible world, a new hope arises. The Happiness Program, which is the creation of a Finnish pharmaceutical genius, Dr. Laura Solomon. With happiness, pills, mind mapping, and microchips, Dr. Solomon intends to build a new world for the worthy few, which sounds like a perfect plan and nothing could go wrong, right? Right. So this is a raw but fun dystopian sci-fi adventure with an unusual premise describing what happens when technology rules humanity. Either you're chipped living inside the AR society, or you're left outside to barely survive. Make sure to check out Unchipped by Taya DeVere. And thanks again to Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you probably never heard of, for sponsoring this episode.
Would you like to hear a couple of meta notes about traveling to the UK with my family before I get to the book specific one?
Yeah, I mean, especially since we're going to go on the angle of American visits the UK and determines they do it wrong.
Well, I'm joking. Most of the differences, I'm like, yeah, this is right, to be honest with you. Notably among them, we got to stop tipping. We just have to stop doing this in the U.S.
So it's so much better
not to tip.
Pay more people a living wage so tipping becomes less necessary.
Yeah, just charge me more for my terrible English breakfast and the tipping is included in it.
I had the same feeling in Spain. It's so much easier.
I also got on to the... maybe I'm going to sound like I just figured out how to program my VCR. I don't know. But using my phone as the contactless payment where I could choose the credit card I wanted to use.
The tap to pay. It's magical.
Tap to pay. And it's more available here. In the last week, I've been like seeing where I could use it. It's more available here. I didn't realize that. Anyway, using my phone, not having to get out my credit card, even to tap to pay with your credit card, it's great. Also, that they bring the credit card machine to you at the restaurant.
Yes.
I haven't been overseas in 20 years, so forgive me if everyone knows this. I have just forgotten. That's awesome. Just do it right there.
It's great.
We're done. We don't have to do the thing where they bring the bill, and then I leave, and they have to wait enough time for me to put the card down, and then they take the card away, they bring it back. Why are we doing this? We don't have to do this. Another thing. And I don't know... Again, the last time I was in the UK, I was coming, it was, 20 years ago now. And I hadn't even lived in New York at that time. So I was coming from Kansas, and London seemed like everything was made of gold. That's how expensive it felt at that time. Mm-hmm. But this time, because I had been in New York, in Portland's, frankly, from a dining point of view, I feel like Portland's cheaper than London. I'm not kidding about this. And I haven't tallied up my credit card bills because I have things I'd like to do without passing out for the next 72 hours.
Oh, do you mean London's cheaper than Portland?
Yeah, for the food, the dining. Yeah. And we didn't do high-end dining. And there's more really high-end dining in London than Portland. But
That's true.
Of places I'd go with my family, I was like, especially when you take into account no tipping, it felt very, very reasonable. Again, strong dollar. And I'm coming from a coastal, blue city rather than my small Kansas hometown, which was like two notches up. But it felt very, very reasonable. And London's a major city. I mean, I don't have to tell you this. Like, it's a serious city, and I didn't find myself often being like, and in fact, and the last thing before, I should use that one because it's a good transition. The books are cheaper.
Oh.
They just are. They had a paperback sitting out of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. That's £10, which with the current conversion rate, that's $12, $12.50.
Interesting.
You cannot get a new paper. You can't get a trade paperback in this United States of America for $12.50.
Definitely can't. You're pushing $20 for a lot of them.
Yeah. And the hardcover is like $24. Not pounds. I did the conversion. And right now the dollar's strong, so you know your mileage may vary. But I was like, it's cheap. The books were cheap. They just were.
It's amazing.
The last thing is, if you have a food allergy, they're going to find out. They ask you all the time, do you have a food allergy? If we're sitting down to the breakfast buffet at our budget hotel, like, does anyone have a food allergy? It's like, God, no. Jeez. They're very worried about food allergies. God bless them. But every single food establishment, like even going to like a Pret, it's like, do you have any food allergies? Like, well, I'm buying a hoagie with cheese and meat and bread on it. I hope I don't have a gluten allergy. Just like blindly hoping that this random sandwich is cool for me, even though
taking
it's the size
flyer
of a football. So there's that. Let's see what. Yeah, those are the things that really struck me. You know, trains are great. What else are you going to say?
Trains are great.
Michelle and I both have a love affair with European, well, all train systems, but the Europeans do it as well as anyone. So we hope the kids loved it. We took a 5-hour train from London to Glasgow. And we sprung for the first class family where it's four of us around a table. Would you like to guess how much that one way train ticket was? 5.5-hour train ride, first class, four people, two kids, two adults. Would you like to guess how much it was?
$75.
Altogether? Yeah, it was $153.
Okay, still very reasonable.
Very reasonable. I've taken cabs from Newark to Times Square that were more expensive than that.
Yeah. That's a miserable experience also.
Oh, yeah, also. And this was delightful.
Yeah. I had that experience in Switzerland where I was like, this is the most cliche thing that a tourist could possibly say, but like, wow, the Swiss rail system.
Yeah. No, it's great. And the kids had a great time. The other thing I'll say about being in central London for 8 days, it was jammed. It was so
in the middle of summer.
People. The middle of summer, like, you know, the AAA attractions were jammed. Though we went to some secondary things, like the British Library wasn't that bad. The Imperial War Museum wasn't that bad. But if you're trying to see the Rosetta Stone, forget about it. Like, you know, go look at a rock outside and say, you know, I bet there were hieroglyphs on that one.
Are the museums still doing the COVID thing where you need to like make a reservation to enter at a particular time?
Yeah. Well, the British Museum and the Tower of London and Westminster Abbey, and I think those are the only three. And but like the Victoria and Albert wasn't.
Okay.
But the Natural History Museum was. So it's really only the top tier stuff. But if you get outside of that a little bit, and then if you go look at not the top tier attractions at any museum, you know, even the British Museum, this can be fine. But it was jam. Scotland was delightful. I can see why Tolkien was like, I need to write a book that has the Shire in it just so I can describe England. The countryside's amazing. Downtown Edinburgh, around the, go Princess Street is the park right in the middle. Go Rock Royal Mile up to Edinburgh Castle, but the whole thing, it feels like you're in fairy tale. We went up to the University of Glasgow, which looks like, and we don't talk about this person, but I'll just say it here, it's the most Hogwartsian MFN place I've ever seen in my life. It's amazing.
Sounds charming.
So that was
lovely.
Great. So there's the top notes. We had a great time. Bookstores. So I already hit the one. Books are cheap.
Okay.
The second one is I went to a couple of foils. I went to Daunt Books, James Daunt, where he made his bones. That's where he started sort of the invasion of Anglophone book retailing. I went to that location. I went into a couple of bookshops by W.H. Smith's, which are bookshops and train stations, they're little ones. And I still don't know how to say Waterstones, I don't care. I didn't ask anybody. Well, you know what I'm talking about. And I went to several of those in Edinburgh and Glasgow and then in London. And then a place called South Kensington Books and a couple other local ones. There, at least amongst the bookshops I went to, it feels like a very, very, and I went to two foils, a very similar experience in all of them.
Okay.
And maybe that's just because I'm coming from the Americanness, so I see like the Britishness, and if you have a better attention to the micro details and differentiations among the British bookstores, then you would know differently than I, which I assume to be the case. But a couple things I noticed. Paperbacks everywhere, and there's just it just feels like the stores have more books in them, not more titles, just more copies. Like they'll have a front table, and the things will be 14 copies high with space between them, just like jammed up like Costco style, but of paperbacks. in independent bookstores. And then, you know, in Daunt Books, I guess it's kind of the archetype for a lot of these. Face out. Like you have to go way back, and it's a charming bookstore. It's got wooden banisters and a second floor and an atrium. It feels jammed. It feels small. It kind of feels like you want, there's sort of like a dustily bibliophilic womb-like experience to most of these bookstores that people get into. But hardbacks are definitely deprecated. Like the new release hardbacks, like they're over to the side and feel small. So I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if the paperback hardback split, which we know is a big deal in America, is even greater in the UK, just about how they're presented. The other thing too is, again, now we're in central London and we're in central European cities, and real estate is at a real premium, so I totally get this. But if you don't want one of those, if you don't want a book that's not face out in the main floor, have fun. Like, go
good,
out.
You mean good luck finding it?
Yeah, it's not going to be there. There's not enough room.
Oh,
there's not
I
a,
see.
Like,
I see.
The thing that we grew up with that enamored us of the book, the Barnes and Nobles of like 1994.
The three-story Barnes and Noble.
Yes, yeah. It was de facto the Library of Alexandria for books in print. And you could go, you didn't go, you know, you got your latte and you saw the, you know, you saw the things in the front, and then you wanted to go get a Tom Robbins novel, or you wanted to go get a paperback of Kurt Vonnegut or whatever. They wouldn't only have that one, they'd have all of Vonnegut and they'd have all the Stephen King.
Yep.
And that's just not the case there. They really are focused on like the front of store book buying experience. And some of those are like, what's new, you know, what's selling. I went into, I think it was a Foyles. Yeah. Right down by the Globe. And you walk in, and there's two tables. One is stacked with Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, and the other one stacked with Lessons in Chemistry.
Huh.
Right there.
I wonder if...
They just think people are there for those.
Are UK publishers and booksellers like all tied up in knots over discoverability the way we are here? Because that kind of solves the problem. Like, we're going to have 15 titles, and you're going to take one of them. Here you go.
Well, I think it's probably, you know, it's that circular thing we talk about, is like people have heard about these books, so maybe they're not in the bookstore for that book. But if you come into the bookstore and you've heard of that book, they want to make sure you see that you can buy. Oh, I heard about this. Any book you could say that about, they want to make sure you see. And there's a giant stack of them, which I think
smart.
Is from a moving units point of view. You know, Josh Cook on the show talked about stack them high, let them fly. This is stack them high, get it in their eye and let them fly. Like, make sure they see it and make sure it's a book they've heard about. And like, you know, there's a Colleen Hoover table and there's other tables there. I was like, okay, am I going to have heard of all the books? Because I walk into Powell's now, you know, on a new release Tuesday, and I look at the new book section. I've heard like 90% of the things they're going to put out there. That's fine. That's my job. That's no big deal. I was like, it's going to be similar. There's not as much crossover as you would think. There's books like, I haven't heard of this author. I have no idea. And it's like got a, you know, Irish Times Gold Star, you know, favorite bestseller thing on it. Like, I have no idea what this thing is. There's this book I saw. It's called Windswept. It's about a woman moving to the Scottish Highlands. I'm like, yes, I'm in the place. I'm going to get this on audio. I'm going to listen to it on the train.
Perfect.
And I'm going to ascend into the heavens. And it's not, you can't get it in the States. No audible. It's not just a no audiobook. I can't even get a print copy of it.
Did you buy it in print there and read it on the train?
I left like a fool.
Jeff!
I'm spoiled. What do you mean to say? I assumed I could get the damn thing. So anyway, there's that. Let's see what else.
I'm so disappointed.
I'm going to do a piece, I don't know, for first edition or maybe the deep dive. I took a bunch of pictures of UK covers of books that I know what the US version looks like. I'm not a graphic designer by trade. I will say, I think in general, I slightly prefer American sensibility to book covers. I don't know why, but I need to think about what it is. And maybe it's just familiarity. I know a lot of people, especially when the Book Depository went out of business, like, where am I going to get my UK book covers? And I don't know if that's sort of a stamp collector's thing where it's different. You know, I'm going to get the variant number one because I'm hoarding it. That's fine. Have fun. I don't care what you do. But is it actual preference or is it scarcity?
Yeah.
But it is, I feel like on the whole, it is different. It is different. And I also told you, we were talking about Zadie Smith, they had, and it's coming out, I think, this next week there. No, maybe it's a global drop date. Anyway, they had handouts about Zadie Smith's The Fraud that you unfolded them.
That's
it was
wild.
Like a big four-color, double-sided, glossy. On one side, it turns into like a poster, probably a half-poster side thing of just The Fraud. On the back is a bunch of stuff about Zadie Smith, her other books, her art biography, why Zadie Smith is cool. I don't think I'd ever seen anything like that in any place. I'd never seen anything like that.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like that. Definitely not for a big historical literary novel.
Yeah,
you know, if they're doing like tear out, take away promotional materials at a bookstore in the U.S. It's for like a big commercial hit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Last thing, and this is kind of funny. So the Foyles I was visiting, which is by the Shakespeare's Globe Theater, is in this, it's kind of in this entertainment complex. I don't remember the name of it, but it's like a cultural event space. And that night there was an author event that Foyles was hosting upstairs. Would you like to guess who the author was?
Oh God. No, I don't want to guess. Was it Zadie
Coulson
Smith?
Whitehead. Coulson Whitehead. Was that
perfect.
We almost came back. I was like, no, we're kind of far away.
You gotta drag your kids are a little
drag
young
the kids.
For Coulson.
Yeah, a little young. It's like, okay. But that was funny. So that's my report from the British bookstores.
Well, sounds like a good time. Ever since you told me about Scotland and getting to see the Highland cows, my Instagram has been serving me pictures.
Is
of them,
that right?
So, like, the robots definitely know something
wow.
is happening.
Good Lord. We made a special trip to see
it.
The Highland cows. Yeah,
a Highland cow is a special thing. That would have been the highlight of my trip, too. I'd be like, screw this bookstore. Get
it's
me
the
to
most
a
Muppet-looking headed character I've ever seen.
Love it.
The bangs. I'm sorry, fringe, for those of you in the UK, that come over its eyes. I don't really see. Anyway. I
love this for you.
This is an important update. The Highland cows are now my daughter's second favorite animal. Really climbed the charts. Sea otters were looking over their shoulders. They're like, "Whoa, are we coming? Are we going? Are we getting taken down today?" Not quite. Sea otters are still safe.
But
the Highland cows went from unranked number 2 in the world in the course of about 48 hours.
Just the multitude of flavors that are captured just by that sea otters are number 1 and Highland cows are number 2.
She likes a thick coat. She likes a thick coat.
Yeah. Love it.
Anyway, there you go. You want to do any reading catch up? Talk about this little book called The Beasting, which you definitely didn't slag and say you were never reading Paul Murray again when I first
read it. Yeah, I mean, I was like, I love Paul. I think my actual statement was I love Paul Murray, but I need him to do like 350 pages instead of 600. But you know what? He's just earned it back. A huge novel. It is set in Ireland, like in a small village, about a family that it's rich people problems. And I was like, oh, I am going to like this. It's this like wealthy family that owns a like car dealership and car repair place. And there a recession has hit. Business is not going well. And maybe there is something else that's happening with the family. And you kind of make your way into the story through their teenage daughter and her best friend who are finishing high school and getting ready, they hope, to go off to Trinity College in Dublin. And then he starts unwinding in each section of the book. We're moving like a little bit farther into the past, how the family ended up in this situation. And first we're with the teenage daughter, and then we're with the son, and then we're with the mother. And he starts like playing with form there, where I was reading a digital galley because like who's going to hold a 600 page book to read it?
Yeah.
And you get to the section from the mother's perspective and it's like it felt stream of consciousness-y and there's very little punctuation. And so then I went and hunted down a hardback copy so I could be like, is this how it really is? Or is this just what's happening in the digital version or in the galley? That is how it really is every time you're in the mother's perspective. Then we're in the dad's perspective, like a little bit farther into the past. And these are big chunks of book that we spend with each of these people. It's not like a carousel quick novel moving through each of their perspectives. Is like this and then this, and it's different parts of their lives that we're getting from each of them. And as we get closer to the end of the book, the sections get shorter and start moving faster, and everything is like coming together and picking up momentum. And it's just really good. It's just really, really good. There is a little there's like some addiction stuff that happens. There is a rape scene that was surprising. So trigger warnings for that. And there's some homophobia on the page as like what is happening in one of the characters' lives in Ireland several decades ago. So just like some warnings for that. I think Paul Murray does a great job of sort of capturing all of this and giving us these people's lives. But like if this thing does not become an adaptation that can take the place of Succession in my heart for like let's unwind a family story.
The Beasting is a little late at the streaming party, Rebecca. I'm kind of worried about this kind of thing.
I know
now.
And it's gonna need a different title for sure if they're gonna like make people pay attention
to
it.
Okay.
Yeah. The Beasting. I mean, it refers to an incident that happens in the story, but you have to get a couple hundred pages in to get that answer. It's great. It's great. And then it's, you know, the end of the season. So I'm doing my, like, what did I miss this summer cleanup. And I picked up The Country of the Blind by Andrew Leland.
Because what'd you think?
Oh, man, it's so good.
It's very good.
It's so good. It's so good. And, like, the perfect blend of memoir and nonfiction and, like, all of the different research that he does into, like, how we understand blindness and the technologies that people have built up to provide support and accommodation for blind people. I was the Hey, Did You Know machine for the week that I was reading that book. And Bob was like, why are all the facts about blindness this week? It's like, oh, I'm reading a book.
Yeah, reading a book.
Yeah,
come on, Bob. You're no rookie. You should know.
I know.
She's, like, she's reading a book about blindness again.
And I think I did tell him, and it just, like, went in one ear and out the other. And I was like, yes, there's a reason that all the facts are about blindness. It was so good. I'm really glad that you spoke about it so highly, because it did nudge me. Did you get any reading done on your trip?
You know, I did a little bit before, and I think I got a little mop up to do. So I mentioned The Great White Bard by Farah Kareem Cooper. I read that, of course, because I do my homework when I do interviews. Very, very good. I finished yesterday The Fraud, but I'm going to hold off on talking about it, because we're going to talk about it together.
Yes.
And I did that by Zadie Smith. I did some audio for the plane. I wanted to get ready. So I read this book called Once Upon a Tome by Oliver. Let's see. Oh, what's his name? Darkshire? Once Upon a Tome. I got to look it up. I have it written down on my... Yeah, Oliver Darkshire, The Misadventures of a Rare Bookseller.
Interesting.
Kind of stumbled into a career as an antiquarian bookseller at Sutherland's Books in London, which is a venerable bookstore. Rebecca, I need to tell you something. I've read two books this year with a bookish pun on the once upon a... Two of them. I've read two
and
of them
plenty,
this year.
Plenty other titles with puns in them, but we've got two once upon a...
I've got two once. I've got Once Upon a Prime by Sarah Hart. And Once Upon a Tome.
Once Upon a Prime is just A-plus work.
Once Upon a Tome's not bad either, especially because it's about books, but Once Upon a Prime, in my mind, got there first. But I'm a little concerned that I've read two books with a pun of this on the same side.
What is the most boring history of X in 10 things you've read this year that you ended up loving?
I'm listening right now. It's not a history. It's not a micro history, but it is. It's also a pun. Empire of the Sum by Keith Houston about the calculator.
What percentage of your reading involves a punny title?
This is what I'm worried about. This is what I'm worried about.
I want to know, and I'm scared of the answer.
It's like, once you have multiple voices in your head, you got to start wondering, which of these should I be listening to? I'm very concerned. But it was really great on audio. Talks about, you know, it's like just the right amount of, like, warmly, curmudgeonly that you want from someone working in an antiquarian bookstore. It was really great. I also, and I don't know... I can't really tell you why I eventually picked this up. I was reading this while I was jet lagged in London while my kids were still sleeping at 3 in the morning on my Kindle. I read Legends and Lattes by Trevis Baldry. Have you heard of this book at all?
No.
Have you seen anything about this? It's sort of a quiet hit, and there's a sequel coming out in November, and the pitch is... you know, like these high fantasy stories where there's a group of, like, misfit adventurers all together and they take down the evil thing and then that's the end of the story. This says, well, what if we picked up our story at the end of that? Like, what happens after? And so the main character is this warrior orc, right? Who, you know, wields a broadsword, and she then wants to open up a coffee shop in the local fantasy village. And it's about her opening up a coffee shop.
Oh, I love that. I will watch that show.
It's called Legends and Lattes, a novel of high fantasy and low stakes by Trevis Baldry. And I'd seen some people talking about it. I'd seen it put out at Powell's.
It's really funny.
And I'd heard just enough about it for it to catch my attention. I was like, this sounds cozy and comforting. And God damn it, it is cozy and comforting.
That's just delightful. I'm so glad that that exists in the world.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know if anyone out there has read this, but... it's kind of a sleeper little fantasy hit. So
it sounds like a good jet lag pick.
It was over too fast. I burned through it. It was over. I could have used six hours of jet lag reading over the spread of a few days.
Over too fast is high praise too.
Yeah.
I was looking for what am I going to take in paperback on this trip with me, because there's going to be beach time and I don't want to take my iPad on the beach.
I'm gonna
make my first foray into the Bardugo verse. And read
which one?
Six of Crows, because I like
Crows.
A heist. I like a heist situation.
You're going to like, I'll be curious to see. Can I suggest something else instead?
Sure.
And maybe this is, we're getting ready to record our summer draft look back. And I'm going to spoil a little bit because there's one book I wish I could take because I think it became the book of the summer. And it's The Guest by Emma Klein. If you're on
I did read that while you were on vacation too.
What did you think of that?
It was good. It was
it's
fun.
Good, right?
Yeah.
Fun.
I've been like very amused following along with the Vulture Book Club emails about it and everyone who, as you were saying, like does not like they lost their minds over an ambiguous ending.
They really, you know what? If we ever need to take down the Western Hemisphere, just write a really big bestseller with an ambiguous ending.
With an ambiguous.
Invade. Yeah. They'll go nuts.
Yeah. It was fun. It was like a fun Saturday read.
Yeah.
I really liked it.
Okay. You already did that. Yeah. I think it's. It's a fun Saturday read. That's the right. You can do it in one sitting, sit outside, have a glass of wine.
Yeah. Like I was getting my hair done this morning. And my hairstylist is going to the beach next week. And she asked me what she should take with her. And I was like, oh, obviously The Guest by Emma Klein.
Obviously. Well, and I think
that's the one.
A lot of people did that because I think it became the hit of the summer in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's a good
one. A pretty good reading wrap up. By the time we talk again, I'm sure we'll have some other stuff to talk about. But until then, go to bookriot.com/listen to get the notes and links to everything we talked about today, including first edition and the Patreon and the deep dive and all the other crap we make for you guys. Thank you so much for listening. You can also email us podcast@bookriot.com. And I think Northington's with me next week.
She is. Yeah, Jen will be here with you.
So we'll probably talk. We'll probably spend 30 minutes crying about Dune 2 being delayed, and then we'll get to the book news.
I'm so sad for y'all for that.
It's okay.
It's a bummer.
Let the writers and actors strike. I don't know if I haven't really read that much about it. I don't know if this is like because of all the other stuff going on.
Yeah,
but that's fine. I'm not
going
to get bent out of shape about it. I'd like
to see. They just want the actors to be available to promote it, and they won't
that makes
be
a ton of
strike.
Sense.
So yeah, it totally does. Yeah.
I was thinking about this. Maybe Jen and I will also talk about how I will not watch The Changeling by Victor Laval because it's too scary. These things happen in any striking situation. I do feel bad for the people who this is their first adaptation, their first acting work. Like Shea Serrano, his series Primo was catching a little bit fire, but he was doing a good job promoting it. He used to write for The Ringer, and now he's doing his own thing.
Yeah, he's
his
great.
Own sort of middle small publishing company called Halfway Books, and he was so excited to do it. And he was a good soldier, right? And he's not doing any of the promotion because that's how it is. But I was like, man, I feel like there should be like, you know, a rookie's exemption. Like if this is your first thing, you should be able to, I don't know. I do feel bad.
It's tough. Yeah, it's really tough.
It's not their fault. It's just, it's bad timing. It's not good for anyone, but I feel like it's especially bad for the Changelings and the Victor Lavals and the Shea Serranos and the people just getting started
I'm
in the world.
Like honestly a little bit surprised that Dune is the only thing we've seen get bumped because of that so far.
Yet. Okay, Rebecca, thanks so much. Talk to you next time.
All right.